Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Kahn, professor of National Security Studies at the U.S. Army War College, and I'm joined by Brigadier Rakesh Kapoor of the Indian Army, and we're here to talk about China's One Belt, One Road initiative, also known as the Belt Road Initiative, the BRI, or One Belt, One Road as OBOR. Rakesh, welcome.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to do this podcast with you. And I would be happy to talk about the One Belt, One Road initiative. But there's a caveat to this, that all the views that I express are my personal views as a student at the U.S. Army War College. And in no way these represent the views of the government of India or any official standpoint that the government is taking.
Well, great, Rakesh. I know that will make you more candid with us and with those who are listening. So let's start very basically with what is the OBOR, the One Belt, One Road Initiative?
To say it very broadly, the OBOR is integration of the Eurasian landmass with the Indo-Pacific maritime routes.
I see.
So there is the land routes of the Eurasian landmarks and then the maritime routes. So that complete integration. It covers, as per Harold Mackinder's, it covers the greater world, you know, Africa, Asia, and Eurasia.
I see.
And the way the Chinese are expressing about the One Belt, One Road initiative is they're talking about economic integration, they're talking about people-to-people contact, they're talking about greater security initiatives to combat common challenges like narcotics, terrorism, separatism, and to build greater security in the whole region. This is the articulated Chinese representation of the Belt Road Initiative, you know. But is that really true is my question.
Well, how do you answer that question? Is this really true? Is this, in your view, China's soft power, or is this China's hard power? How do you view it?
There are two, three things that we have to understand when we talk about the OBOR. Is firstly, China realizes that its economy is slowing down.
Right.
It has to take measures to sustain that kind of growth rate. It has still not achieved the, you know, the standards of living for its people that it wanted to. So what does it do? It must create opportunities for greater investment. The other thing is China today suffers from a large amount of overcapacity in manufacturing and production. That industrial overcapacity needs an outlet.
I see.
It is also looking for raw materials. Where does it get those raw materials from? It is also looking as how does it extend its geopolitical influence. Now, the way I look at the One Belt, One Road initiative is that this is one way that China is extending its reach. And it's going to do a metallurgical graphing of the areas where this road was going to go through. And all those raw materials are going to come into China. And that is going to help it improve its standard of living. The poorer classes would improve, their standard of living would rise. And their industrial overcapacity would get a vent into these other areas. It also, another big factor in this is the fact that it is willing to, assist in developing of infrastructure in all those areas, particularly in those resource-starved areas. It is giving loans through the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank, etc.
Right.
It gives it a reach into those regions.
I see. And because some folks have characterized One Belt, One Road as a type of China's Marshall Plan, that it's more about soft power. It's like, because China realizes it has a problem with soft power. So this initiative is actually, as you suggest, it's not just about extending its geopolitical influence, but it's about also helping it develop the ability to make itself more appealing to the region and to other regions as well.
I totally agree with that view. You know, it is also extending its soft power because when the But I would hasten to add, you know, this is soft power laced with elements of hard power. And to just amplify on this aspect of soft power, I was reading an article the other day in one of these newspapers. In a city like Islamabad today, there are a large number of Chinese restaurants. And in a country where pork is never eaten, today pork is available, and these restaurants are happily selling pork.
Oh, interesting.
Look at the influence of soft power. This is also going to temper the culture of these countries. And the fact that these Chinese goods are available, today China is investing heavily in learning English.
That's right.
And they are going across to these nations and, you know, breaking the language barrier. And in certain countries, Mandarin has started being included in the core curriculum of schools.
Well, that is interesting because Mandarin, as we know, is a very difficult language to learn. And that's one of the obstacles some people have said about China's soft power is it is very difficult to learn the language and therefore difficult to understand the culture and perhaps find that culture appealing.
I think the fact is money makes the mayor go around, you know. The Chinese are learning English, and where they're investing heavily, those countries are willing to learn Mandarin so that the interaction becomes better. But I would also like to add here, wherever they're doing these investments, it's all open tendering. So,
and what do you mean by that?
It's open tendering that any of the... countries can participate, any company can participate in that.
Right.
And the lowest bidder gets the contract. And as you know, the way the Chinese do bidding, it's most of the Chinese companies, which are Chinese infrastructure companies, which are getting these contracts. Mm. And with so much of influx of Chinese population into those countries, automatically extends to soft power because the Chinese culture comes in. And,
right.
And it also facilitates the fact that this is employment opportunities for Chinese and not the local population of those countries.
Now, you bring up an interesting point where this extension of perhaps soft power does come with some risks to China. Are there any other risks than the notion that bringing in Chinese workers may alienate the population? Is there, would you say there are any risks to China beyond that fact alone?
No, definitely this extension of soft power has, you know, also extends the risks which may augur in the future, particularly in areas which are disturbed in China. When you look at the Uyghurs,
right.
Wherever the construction of the corridors are taking place in those regions, the external influences are also possible. In fact, recently there has been reports that certain Uyghur separatists were being trained on the western border of Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's true. What's interesting is you brought up earlier this notion of how expensive these projects are and how China's capacity, economic capacity, is actually slowing down. So this is an ability for China to actually expand its economy a little bit, expand its investments. So some people say it's not a Marshall Plan. It's actually a way for them to export their economic pathologies. So, for example, debt. They're exporting debt. But they may also be exporting instability into the region as well. Would you find anything that might support that, say, within what's called the CPEC, which is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor?
You know, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is a very interesting corridor. Firstly, it runs from Gwadar in Balochistan, which is a disturbed area in Pakistan.
Right, lots of instability.
A lot of instability. And goes up to Kashgar, which is in Sinkiang province, which is again disturbed.
Right.
So the terminal ends of both these, of this corridor, are disturbed. And it passes through Aksai Chin, which is again disputed territory of this thing. That is the territory that, it's Indian territory out of Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, which Pakistan has leased out to China.
To China.
Now, what is really happening? The CPEC gives China entry into the warm waters of the Indian Ocean.
Right.
It integrates the communication routes from the Gulf of Hormuz into mainland China. It integrates the communication routes from Africa into mainland China. And interestingly, China has spent $46 billion or is planning to spend, it's not yet, it's planning to spend $46 billion US dollars for the CPEC. with the proviso that the port of Gwadar will be leased out to China.
To China, right.
And what are the implications of this leasing out? Firstly, there'll be, you know, it'll be a world-class port. Second, China is now the ability to look into what's happening with the U.S. forces operating in the Persian Gulf.
Oh, that's right.
It has the ability to now encircle India from along its western borders as well as eastern borders. It is also engaging with Sri Lanka, as you're aware,
because
it's building the Hambantota. And with the CPEC being disturbed, like I initially mentioned, there is Gwadar, Balochistan, there's Aksai Chin in the middle, and there's Sinkiang. Now, if you see, the security of this corridor is so fragile.
Right.
This gives China the excuse or the opportunity to now deploy troops there. In fact, there are reports already for security of the CPEC. They are planning to deploy a division worth of troops.
I see.
Into this region.
So it's interesting that soft power is actually the vessel by which hard power can extend itself into other areas, including into a partner country like Pakistan.
You know, it's benign infrastructure development, which is leading to a geopolitical increase of geopolitical influence. If you invaded those areas, you had to govern them.
Right.
But this is just benign. They're saying we are doing nothing.
Yeah.
We're just developing infrastructure.
Now, can you talk a little bit about Balochistan in particular when it comes to the internal politics of Pakistan and how China is actually being asked by local authorities to help mitigate disputes?
I'll give you a little background of Balochistan. When India and Pakistan became independent in 1947, Balochistan never wanted to join Pakistan.
I see.
You know, they thought they were closer to the Indian mainland, or they wanted to be independent. In fact, there was a person called Abdul Ghaffar Khan who was called the Frontier Gandhi.
Huh?
And he wanted, you know, greater integration with India or go independent totally. And there's always been a separatist movement against Pakistan and Balochistan. Now, Pakistan has really not been able to control Balochistan. And this is historically proven. Areas that Pakistan is unable to govern, it tends to lease it out to other stronger powers. Aksai Chin, it was unable to govern, it gave it to China. Balochistan is the other region which is unable to govern. And with the CPEC, the governance of Balochistan would automatically go into the hands of China. And interestingly, what they're articulating to the common people of Balochistan is, look, we are making serious investments into Balochistan to improve the quality of life of people of Balochistan. And what is this manifested into? There's now an internal rife within Pakistan. Khyber Pakhtunkhwala, people feel that all the investments will go to Balochistan.
Yeah.
And they're wanting mediation from China to assure them that there'll be equal amount of investments in Khyber Pakhtunkhwala. And as you mentioned, you know, the soft power is leading to greater influence of China into these regions. If China starts mediating into internal politics of other nations, it is achieving, though China has publicly articulated and publicly voiced its opinion to say that this is an internal matter and they're not going to meddle around with it.
Right, as one of the countries that is a proponent of hard sovereignty, not to get involved in internal matters, and yet they're being pulled into internal matters where those regions you spoke about in Pakistan are looking not to Islamabad, but to Beijing.
Because they feel that Beijing is the most stable government vis-a-vis their own government. You know, the retention of, or the longevity of the government in Beijing is higher than the government in Islamabad.
Well, perhaps one final question to ask you is, why is this relevant to, say, United States national security? Why should America care about the One Belt, One Road initiative?
Personally, I feel, you know, that possibly after all this announcements by America, the rebalance to the Indo-Pacific.
Right.
China, for some reason, thought it was containment of China.
Of course, right.
And this is their response to the proposed containment of China. that we are going to integrate the greater part of the world, and we would extend our economic influence through this One Belt, One Road. And importantly, what has happened is, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership having gone out,
yes,
China has been fast enough, you know, to galvanize the RCEP, the Regional Cooperation Economic Partnership, the One Belt, One Road initiative. And even if you see in the recent summit, which was held on the 14th of May, 60 countries, more than 60 countries have affirmed their participation. In
That's
fact,
right.
some of the countries of the European Union have started talking
That's
about
right. yeah.
being integrated with it. And most countries in the region are now in a dilemma. My security partner is
yes.
the United States, but my largest economic partner is
China.
So therefore, for the overall influence of China, overall influence of the United States, they'll have to wait and watch as to how this whole thing pans out.
Yes, there are lots of strategic dilemmas, for sure, with the One Belt, One Road initiative that presented not just to the United States, but as you've mentioned, to China as well, and to the region.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much, Rakesh Kapoor of the Indian Army, for sharing your thoughts on the One Belt, One Road initiative.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. What a pleasure.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.